Tonight is film night. Pedro Almodovar's new film is an autobiographical look back on the highs and lows of a life as a film director. Never Grow Old is an Irish-made western starring John Cusack. An Angel Has Fallen is the third in the Gerard Butler, Mike Banning Has Fallen franchise. And a compendium of horror stories is on offer in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. I'm joined by Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor, who have seen all four films. We'll start this evening with the renowned Spanish filmmaker Pedro Almodovar, who has teamed up with one of his earliest collaborators, the actor Antonio Banderas, to bring us Pain and Glory, the story of an aging film director looking back on his life. I said it was probably autobiographical, Justin. Tell us, what is the story?
Well, it's about an aging film director, Salvador Malo, who's getting to a point in his life where his body is no longer working as smoothly as it once did. He's got insomnia, migraines, his back hurts, and these ailments have stopped him from directing, which has been his life, the thing that's given him meaning. And so he starts to sort of wander his past, remembering his childhood with his mother, and reconnecting with his first major actor, Alberto Crespo, who he had a big falling out with in their most successful movie, his most successful movie. So really tracing a lot of the things that have gone on in Pedro Almodovar's life as
and,
well.
And how do we find him? Do we find him disillusioned, disappointed?
No, he's very heartbroken, I think, with what's happened with his body. And it's very easy to empathize with him. There's sort of a comical animation bit at the beginning where he goes through all his ailments and everything that's going on in his body, and they kind of animate these internal kind of pains. And you very quickly find yourself sort of sympathizing with someone whose body is no longer helping him on his own journey. And even the decisions he makes, he starts taking heroin in the film for the first time quite late in his life. You do find yourself sort of hoping he finds his way out of this dark place that he's in, but not in a melodramatic way, in a very realistic and lovely way.
So, as we said, it's Antonio Banderas is playing the the Almodovar character. So how does he take on the role? Do you think does he get in to the character?
He actually does, literally, because apparently he's wearing Almodovar's clothing. And this is one of the sort of, this is actually a really successful effect, because I would guess that Almodovar might be one size bigger than Banderas. So the clothing just looks like a little bit ill-fitting, which makes it look like he's shrunk, and that this again is part of the deterioration, that he's no longer fitting into his clothing. As I also understand it, the apartment in the film is actually kitted out with Almodovar's items. So, you don't need to be a method actor to see what's going on here. And also the two of them have had, their lives have been totally entwined, Banderas and Almodovar. And Almodovar said in interview, this is about me, this film. And also Banderas has spoken in interview about having had a heart attack, about, coming back from that. And, he's in a new relationship. And so really nobody's making any secret of the fact that this is, it's almost like Banderas is Almodovar's muse, which is curious, because you might have thought, oh, maybe Penelope Cruz might have been, because she's in it too. And I mean, I'd have loved to seen a little bit more of her in the film. I think she's fantastic in it. She looks glowing in there's an early sequence at a river where she's washing clothes.
Yes, because she plays the filmmaker's mother.
Yes.
In the youngest version
of the
filmmaker.
In the flashbacks, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and what role do the flashbacks take? Does it disjoint the film, or is it very easy flowing?
No, it's very easy flowing. I mean, it's done kind of, a lot of it is around his heroin use. So it's the only painkiller that's really working for him at one point. So he gets very sleepy, and then we kind of enter into this kind of, well, I don't want to give any secrets away because it would be a bit of a spoiler, but this kind of dreamlike past world that he's in, that is very representative. Almodovar grew up in great poverty, and that poverty is very much a subject of those flashbacks. But it's done in this very lovely, dreamy way. As he kind of falls asleep on the couch, we sort of enter his dream world, and it's done very, very smoothly.
Now, a lot of his films are very autobiographical or have autobiographical elements, Ruth. Is this more self-indulgent?
It depends how you go, how you feel about this. And I think it, Justin and I were saying, Justin was relating to this, I don't want to give too much away, Justin, but, you know, as a guy of a certain age. I'm not, clearly, or not a guy, anyway. There are moments where you might kind of feel a little bit of, oh, really? Do we really need to see, you know, the inner workings of his ailments? But on the other hand, I think it's so lavish. It's such a beautiful film. It's got a fantastic soundtrack as well that, you know, it's a bit churlish to complain about making a film about yourself. It certainly is absolutely his most autobiographical film.
So Alberto Iglesias is his long-term musical collaborator.
Yes, and he is, and the soundtrack is worth listening to of its own. But even, you know, right from those opening credits, it's kind of swirling like paint mixes.
Really, we know him as a filmmaker who has brash, bright colours. Is that evident in this?
Yes, but it's amazing because when you do see the clothes that he wears in his normal life and you see inside his apartment, you realise he is just taking the colours from his own life and putting them on screen, that there is kind of no barrier between him as a filmmaker and the films that he makes. And that sort of is been the point of a lot of his movies, but I think more so in this one. And I agree with Bruce. You know, when I heard, oh, it's a film, you know, a film about a filmmaker, you kind of have a bit of a moment, but it's just done so maturely and so sensitively that it really becomes about much larger things, about aging and maturity and our past and how it impacts us.
So out of five, Justin, for Pain and Glory.
Well, it is inspired by 8.5, and he gets very, very close to that, to Fellini's masterpiece. So I did give it 5. I really thought it was excellent.
Great endorsement. And you, Ruth?
I gave it 4.5, but I loved it too. There's a terrific scene in a Q&A about his film that brought it up to that half for me. I loved that sequence.
A Q&A with the film director.
Yes, but he's actually on his mobile phone. He's not at it.
Okay, intriguing. Next up is Irish-made Western Never Grow Old, starring Emile Hirsch and John Cusack, from Irish director and writer Ivan Kavanagh, who spoke to Arena on Monday. And Ruth, we have spoken in the past about Ivan Kavanagh.
We have indeed.
About your book. We talked about Canal, I think, when you were in, talking about the title of your book.
Irish Cinema in the 21st Century. Yes. Thanks for the plug.
So would you take us maybe through his earlier work briefly and situate this Never Grow Old?
Yeah, I've always been a big fan of Kavanagh's. He started out in, you know, it's not even mini-budget, it's micro-budget filmmaking. And he made I loved these very, very early horror films. There's one called The Fading Light. My favourite was actually Tin Can Man, which is very influenced by Eraserhead and by Lynch's kind of work.
David Lynch, yes.
Yeah, David Lynch. Sorry. And he then he made these very much appreciated films, but of course tiny audience for them. He then moved, as we were saying, into the mainstream with The Canal. You can get that on Netflix. And it was a much more kind of global looking piece, much less specifically Irish, and with much more references to like J horror. And so that's his career to date. And it seems to me that he's edging always closer into the mainstream, and that with each film, and so you get The Canal, that was 2014. Now, 5 years later, we get Never Grow Old, the film we're discussing today, which is moving him further again into the mainstream, and I think that's his trajectory.
A classic Western?
Oh, absolutely classic Western. I mean, it's set in the Old West. It's set in 1849 in the Old West. It is wrought with brutality. This is a space where civilization is struggling and basically losing. It reminded me of the TV series Deadwood a little bit, which is, you know, many of the themes in Deadwood, which I loved, are here in microscopic detail, obviously.
It's been dragged to polar opposites, isn't it? When we find the town first, Justin, it's in the hands of the preacher. The preacher is almost running the town and his morals go. And then into this comes the character played by John Cusack.
Yes, Dutch Albert. Yes, you know, and it's very interesting that the preacher's journey is very interesting, because when he starts with the sermonizing, he seems very dictatorial and controlling and repressive. And you end up on very much on his side of the need for morality in this kind of wild frontier that otherwise creates people like Dutch Albert, who have a code, but it's well outside sort of the norms of civilization. And I mean, the Dutch Albert character is fascinating. There's all this stuff about friendship. He kills two friends and then he makes friends with Emile Hirsch's Patrick Take and goes, huh, you kill two friends and then you make a new one. And it's just sort of amazing, his need for some representation of friendship and civilization in that world as well.
Tell us a little bit about the Patrick Tate character. He is an Irish character.
Yes, he speaks so little that I didn't know he was Irish until John Cusack's character asked him where he was from, because he hadn't spoken enough to even get a sense of it. It's a very minimalistic film in that sense. But yes, he's married to a French woman and they're heading to California and they've stopped in this town. And John Cusack has some theories on being Irish in America.
Yes, I think this is just a very good time to play this clip. Patrick Tate, as we said, played by Emil Hirsch, and Dutch Albert, played by John Cusack, are getting acquainted. And Cusack reminds Hirsch that he's an Irish immigrant and that he'll always be an outsider.
Where are you from?
Ireland.
What do you do?
I'm a carpenter and undertaker.
You're an Irish undertaker. But you're Catholic too, huh?
Not anymore.
Oh, they made you convert, did they? Oh, these decent Christian folks. They don't like the Irish much, do they? Why is that? Because they think too many of you coming over here and use all a bunch of rats. No better than savages. That's how they think, isn't it? I bet they wouldn't even talk to you unless you converted. Is that right?
Things are all right now.
Yeah, but you're still Irish. You can't change that. And every time they look at you, they'll be reminded of death. They're gonna die. You'll always be an outsider here. You'll never be one of them, no matter what you do. Never. I understand that.
John Cusack as Dutch Albert and Patrick Tate, played by Emil Hirsch in Never Grow Old. So it's set in the earlier part of the frontiers. It's in the 1840s, which I suppose ties in with the fact that you would think Patrick is a refugee from the famine in Ireland. Now, it's an Irish-made film, and it's made in Ireland.
Yes, shot in Connemara.
So how does it look, and do you buy it as an American Western?
I think so. I mean, what they've done is they've kept the camera very tight. So this is clearly not Monument Valley. You don't get that widescreen effect of the classic Western, in fact. So it's all about the mud and the cabins. And so that works. If I hadn't known it was shot in Connemara, it wouldn't have bothered me, the look of it. Oddly enough, it's actually Emil Hirsch's accent, which you just heard in that clip, bothers me slightly more, because we have fantastic Irish male actors, and it's surprising to hear somebody who is slightly struggling with a slightly hammy Irish accent taking that role. I think it's a little bit of a shame. And
yes, because there are Irish actors.
There are many
yes.
Irish actors who could have easily done it, and Colin Farrell has played in Westerns, so he might have been too old for the part, but yeah, there were people who could have done it. So that's a jarring part to me, and that's more jarring to me than the setting. But I think in terms of setting, it works, and it is just, I suppose, I don't see it as really departing quite far enough from the genre to have really made its mark. And it seems to me to be a little bit by the numbers in terms of what you might expect. And it is somebody who's feeling his way into this new genre and doesn't want to kind of break the mold too much. So, you know, it's quite sequential. Something happens, and then the next thing happens, and then the next
yes,
thing happens.
And things are getting worse and worse and
things
worse.
Things are getting blacker and blacker.
Yeah.
And again, you know, it's funny, and I suppose it's because I knew he was a horror filmmaker before, but there was something of the horror film about the way it was shot too. In particular, its emphasis on blood and bleeding and gore. And even that use of the extreme close-up as a kind of shock effect. And it's always, always leading, as that exchange tells us, towards a brutal ending.
I think John Cusack, I think you agree, is pretty much the star of this. Let's listen to him again. Here he is as Dutch Albert and has a last word with his old friend Bill, played by Paul Ronan, before killing him for double-crossing him.
Bill. Wake up now. Still with us? I've been to see your family, Bill. I'm going to take good care of them.
You touch them, I'll kill you.
Got your guts hanging out all over the place. Got maybe 2 minutes left. Don't embarrass yourself, Bill.
Oh, Jesus.
You should try and help him.
Jesus Christ. Why is the Undertaker here?
He's here to bury you, Bill.
No,
Don't thank me. I know you'd do the same for me.
No.
These men used to be friends of mine. No. Just in case you think this is cold-blooded murder, it ain't. They stole from me. Oh. I warned them not to, but they did it anyway. Please. They deserve a good Christian burial.
Wait!
Now let's get them buried.
It's not like Dutch Albert to worry about things being in cold blood or not. That's John Cusack playing Dutch Albert and Paul Ronan as Bill. Do you agree with Ruth, Justin, that it's really saying nothing new in terms of a Western?
Yeah, I mean, the way that Unforgiven really broke new ground, I think, with the Western, this really feels like a cousin of the kind of tropes that Eastwood was pushing in that film. And it's just that it doesn't go anywhere new. And the kind of, yeah, this descending sequence of, you know, someone dies, then someone really young dies, then a pregnant woman is shot. Like, it really almost becomes a caricature of the Western. Like, it didn't really know exactly what it wanted to do.
Ivan said when he was saying that it was Heaven's Gate was a film that, you know, a flawed masterpiece, but a film that he really likes in terms of, and I think he really liked playing with the immigrant experience.
The immigrant experience is interesting, and that brings you back to John Ford, for instance, who regularly featured Irish characters, but more as knockabout humour. So here he's taking the Irish character seriously. And I did think that was absolutely the most interesting part of the film, that first clip you played. It got my attention, but it didn't really follow through because nothing that he does actually is a consequence of being an immigrant. He would have done it anyway if he'd been another character. So I don't think that that's threaded through enough into the plot to make it different enough.
So out of five, Ruth?
I gave it three in a great attempt, but with limitations.
Justin?
Well, the way it captured the rain and mist and mud of Connemara was great. I gave it 3.5, a little too nihilistic for me to go.
Okay, 3.5 and 3 out of 5 for Never Grow Old from Ivan Kavanagh. From 1849 and the Wild West now to 1968, Pennsylvania, our third film is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, a horror film about a group of high school friends who get more than they bargain for when they venture into a haunted house, of course, on Halloween. Tell us a little bit about this, Ruth.
Actually, I think you've just said it. That is the plot.
Something horrible is going to happen.
Yes, for sure. I mean, it is. This is, and we were talking about predictability. This is a totally predictable horror movie. They enter into this haunted house. Mysteriously, doors start clunking and creaking, and for some extraordinary reason, they're locked into this room. The central character, who's actually a really good actress, she's Stella, played by Zoe Margaret Coletti. She picks up this book of stories, and she takes it home. And this book of stories then starts writing new stories. With blood. And so you're looking at the book and it starts writing its next story. And each time the story starts writing itself, it's predicting the death of one of this group of high school friends.
Okay, in this clip, it's about the Sarah Bellows myth, which presumably is very important. Stella, played by Zoe Margaret Coletti, and Augie, played by Gabrielle Rush, and Chuck, played by Austin Zajur, and Tell Ramon, played by Michael Garza, the myth of Sarah Bellows.
The Bellows had a secret, a daughter, that they never allowed to leave the house. The myth is that there was something really off about her.
A really scary part is that her family erased her from every single portrait. To this day, nobody's ever found a picture of Sarah.
They disowned her.
Better run!
So what happened to her?
Kids would come from all over in hopes to get a peek at strange Sarah. And though they never saw her, they could hear her through the wall. Sarah told them stories. Scary stories. Some kids never returned home. Children around town died. Poisoned, they said. Everyone knew it was Sarah. But before the mob could even get their hands on her, she'd already hung herself with her own hair. And as the legend goes, if you come to the Bellows house at dark and ask Sarah to tell you a story, it'll be the last story you ever hear.
It's a lot of hangings in the movies tonight. That's a clip from a Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Justin, it's directed by Andrea Overdahl.
Yes.
But then there's Guillermo del Toro. Does he direct a section of it, or what's his involvement
in
it?
He's the producer, and as far as I could tell from my research, wrote the first draft of the screenplay, which was then finished off by the Hageman brothers, who did the Lego Movie and Troll Hunters and some other kind of tween TV, and it's sort of very much aimed at that kind of market.
And he, Del Toro, obviously directed Pan's Labyrinth. Do you get that feel from this film?
Well, I think the thing, the greatest connection for me was, and it's true of the book it's based on by Alvin Schwartz, is that teenagers die in the movie. And the way that it pans Labyrinth, the way the protagonist, the way she dies, the young girl at the end, I think that these teenagers aren't all going to come out at the end was something that he really wanted to kind of carry on from Pan's Labyrinth and to honour the books and what they were doing.
At the horror genre, Ruth, is often about something else rather than just the film it's making. And Richard Nixon and his whole time seems to be important in this.
Yes, it plays in the background the whole time. So they're nearly every time they go into somebody's house, the television is playing, and it's 1968, so the Vietnam War is on. It turns out, I don't think I'm giving anything away, to say that Ramon is revealed to be a draft dodger. And then you have, you know, Nixon in kind of gung-ho, full-on war mode. I think it is inviting us to make connections between, you know, republicanism then and republicanism now. I think it's probably gratuitous for its audience who will not be much moved by this, and who are there, you know, to be jumping out of their seats in terror.
And Justin, is it classic horror? Has it got all the tropes of a horror movie?
Well, you know, there's a scene that takes place in the in a drive-in theater, and they're playing Night of the Living Dead, and it's very much that very classic horror. It's all jump surprises, you know, a door opens and you go forward and somebody grabs you from behind. Like, it's all those kind of things, rather than The Shining, something that's psychologically creeping you out or disturbing you. No, it's very much the shock and surprise, and you're grabbed from the other direction.
Did it scare you?
I am a complete Freddy cat when it comes to horror films. You guys had me review The Conjuring 2, and I didn't sleep well for about 2 months after that. This, no, because it didn't really have that effect, because it was so predictable in terms of there's obviously about to be a surprise, there's obviously about to be a shock. And that's when you start to think that it's really being made for a very specific market of 12 to 17-year-olds. And if you're older than that, it's not scary enough. If you're younger than that, it's too scary.
And out of five?
I think if you're 13 to 17, it's a 4. I wouldn't really encourage people outside that age to go, mainly because they won't get that horror thrill, or they'll be too frightened if they're too young. So I almost can't star it for the general audience. But I think it's very well done for that tween audience. So 4 for them.
4 for them. And were you scared to catch at it, Ruth?
No, I mean, I actually did find that the build-up at the beginning was a bit slow. I thought it got a bit... It took its time to start going boo and jumping out of corridors at you. So I gave it a 3.5 for not scaring me enough.
A 3.5 and 4 for whoever, if the right audience goes to see it. And that's for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Finally, we have Angel Has Fallen, latest in a series of films starring Jared Butler as he plays Mike Banning, and this is the third. Is it right to say a franchise in Has Fallen?
Yeah, apparently. I have to say it was new to me, because I don't think I've seen the others. Olympus Has Fallen 2013, London Has Fallen 2016. I don't know how they could have passed me by, but somehow I've got through life without having
but
seen them.
But he seems to be always protecting a president, doesn't he?
He's protecting a president. It's President Trumbull. And here he's played by Morgan Freeman, but the identity comes and goes. It's played by different actors through different outings of the franchise. It is a franchise, yeah.
All right, but in this one it's Morgan Freeman.
Yes. But he has to protect the president. He's a Secret Service, you know, tough guy.
Yes, and poor Jared Butler, Mike Banning, is in a rough state when we meet him in the film. Isn't that right? He's a bit bruised.
Yes, kind of a bit of a carry on from what they've been doing with the James Bond, that there are actually consequences from the action movies. So he's got migraine headaches. His spine needs fusing because he's got damage from all the fights he's been in. So it's very much a kind of more real, starts out with a very realistic kind of look at the consequences of Olympus falling and London falling in the first two films. And yes, he's not sure if he can continue on in this role is kind of the question that they're laying out for the audience.
Well, in this clip, Mike, played by Gerard Butler, is under attack with his reclusive father in the woods. But his father, played by Nick Nolte, has some tricks up his sleeve.
Hurry up, damn it!
I didn't tell you to run down there.
Well, I hope you got more fun and games because we're about to be overrun.
Who pulled up that wire?
What wire?
It leaves warehouse.
Go get it, man.
Go!
Really?
You're welcome.
Nick Nolte and Gerard Butler there in Angels. Angel Has Fallen. So, is it exciting? It sounds, I mean, we took out loads of bomb blasts out of that. We only gave our listeners about two bomb blasts.
Yes, the director is a former stuntman. He had done almost 50 films as a stuntman before, I'll call it transitioning into directing. And certainly the stunts are exciting, as one would hope and expect from this kind of film. The plausibility of the plot is low to nil. the assassination attempt and on the president's life. And of course, Benning gets framed and then becomes a bit of the fugitive there for a little while. And yeah, so all the chases are done quite well. There is a feeling in the final fight of that endless stream of baddies, you know, no matter how many he kills, another four come through the next door. So a bit of that's a bit cliche, but it's not awful.
Okay, out of five?
Two and a half. No risks, no major surprises.
Two and a half for you, Ruth. Did you think?
Yeah, I gave it three. I mean, I thought if you know what you're going to see when you go to see it, and you'll get it, and so why not? So three, yeah.
Okay, two and a half and three out of five for Angel Has Fallen. Pain and Glory and Never Grow Old are on limited release, and Angel Has Fallen and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark are on general release. Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor, thank you very much.